Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Dr. Steffi Wohlhandler, co-founder of the group Physicians for a National Health Program, who examines insurance giant Aetna's plan to exit from most Obamacare exchanges and the need for a Medicare for All single-payer system. Dietrich Asante Mohammed of the Corporation for Enterprise Development, who discusses the major findings of a new report titled The Ever-Growing Gap that examines America's increasing racial wealth divide. And Pamela Rausch and Sherry Mullins of Clendenin, West Virginia, who talk about how they stepped up to coordinate disaster relief in their town devastated by a recent flood and the ongoing need for volunteers. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Since tough-talking Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte took office in late June, some 2,000 people have died in violence after the new president launched a war on drug gangs, nearly 800 at the hands of police and over 1,000 at the hands of vigilante groups targeting suspected drug dealers. Since the wave of extrajudicial killings began, President Duterte's public approval rating has soared to over 90%, despite complaints from opposition legislators, human rights groups, and the nation's allies, such as the United States. Weeks before he was sworn in, Duterte, often called Asia's Donald Trump, encouraged citizens to confront drug gangs directly. Human rights activists protested at several schools against the killings and Duterte's threat to place the country under martial law if the Philippine Supreme Court attempted to block his fight against crime. At the same time, the nation's jails are packed with many thousands of people who have turned themselves in out of fear of being targets of extrajudicial killings. The violence has gotten so severe that the International Criminal Court may establish a tribunal to investigate. Yet Duterte's Justice Secretary Vitaliano Aguirre dismissed the prospect of an inquiry, saying, "Criminals are not humanity." Arizona Secretary of State Michelle Reagan certified 177,000 signatures supporting a November statewide referendum on whether to legalize small amounts of marijuana for recreational use. Voters in the Grand Canyon state will join residents of Nevada, California, Maine, and Massachusetts in deciding this year if they want to legalize cannabis. Colorado and Washington state were the first states to legalize use of marijuana for recreational use in 2012. According to the Center for Public Integrity, the new wave of ballot measures to legalize the use of pot illustrates the growing influence of the legal cannabis industry, who have bankrolled many of the recent ballot measures. Up to this point, major donors supporting legalization had not been connected to marijuana growers. In Nevada this year, three-quarters of the major campaign donors on the pro-legalization side of the ballot question have ties to the marijuana industry. In Arizona, at least 26 of the 35 top donors potentially stand to make a profit if recreational marijuana is legalized there. The campaign thus far has raised $2.2 million. Last year in Ohio, voters rejected a marijuana measure that would have given the industry investors who paid for the campaign the exclusive right to farm pot in the state. Ethan Nadelman of the Drug Policy Alliance is worried about the growing role of industry cash. He warns that legalization advocates' ability to raise funds for ballot measures from people who are driven by social justice values and not profit is diminishing. During the long days of summer, traffic stretches for miles outside the entrance to Yellowstone National Park, with tourists eager to see the gushing Old Faithful geyser and view wildlife like elk and buffalo. Every year, 4 million visitors come to Yellowstone, long known as America's Wild Wonderland. As the National Park Service celebrates its 100th anniversary on August the 25th this year, over 300 million people visit America's national parks annually, and the wear and tear is showing. "If we're not past the point of no return in some of our parks, then we're close to it," says Jack Turner, a former university philosophy instructor who has worked in the parks for 40 years. He says, "Yosemite Village is as crowded as New York City or Calcutta. It's appalling what we're doing to these places that we claim to hold as sacred." Critics say the Park Service, beleaguered by deteriorating roads and buildings, threats to natural resources, overwhelming public use, and the potential effects of climate change, is ill-equipped to steward its 411 parks, cultural sites, and historical monuments for another 100 years. They believe the sacred national park experience that so many people journey to see has already vanished at some of the most popular destinations and will only get worse without a serious infusion of money and a rededication to preservation. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Nigel Victor Rees.
Aetna, the Hartford, Connecticut-based insurance giant, the nation's third largest, announced last week that next year the company will be pulling out of 11 of 15 states where it offers policies in the Affordable Care Act's health exchanges. The company says it's lost $430 million in profits since it began offering individual policies on the ACA exchanges in January 2014. Aetna complained that those purchasing insurance policies are sicker and costlier than expected. However, news reports and internal company documents indicate that the move to exit Obamacare came in response to the U.S. Justice Department's decision to block the proposed merger between Aetna and Humana, the nation's fifth-largest insurer. Apart from Aetna, other insurance companies, including UnitedHealthcare, Humana, and Blue Cross Blue Shield, also have plans to leave ACA health exchanges in 2017. Your reporter spoke with Dr. Steffi Woolhandler, co-founder of the group Physicians for a National Health Program and a professor at the City University of New York's School of Public Health at Hunter College. Here she examines the decision by Aetna to pull out of state ACA exchanges, the problems of coverage created by for-profit medicine, and her support for establishing a single-payer Medicare-for-all system that would provide universal affordable care to everyone in the U.S.
Well, Aetna's exodus just illustrates what a crazy idea it was to think that you could get to universal coverage through the private health insurance industry. Private health insurance industry makes money by taking your premiums and providing as little care as possible. And they're only willing to stay in the market as long as they make a profit by doing that, by taking premiums and not paying out too much in care. And they found in ACA that they took the premiums, but people were sick and needed the care. And they just said, well, we're not going to participate. We can't make a profit, and, you know, we're taking our marbles and going home. So certainly Aetna pulled out. Several of the other major insurers have pulled out of markets, generally fewer numbers of counties than Aetna just did. And in many parts of the country, there's only one option under the exchange. And, of course, that's not really an option because you have to pay a big fine on your taxes if you don't enroll in the insurance company. So you basically have a take-it-or-leave-it situation in many parts of the country. There's currently one big county, Pinal County, that in Arizona that has 400,000 people and no insurance company saying they're going to offer an exchange plan next year. Now, this can change because the bids on the exchange plans go in October, but it definitely illustrates that this was a crazy idea to think you're getting to universal health care through profit-seeking private insurance companies. And what we needed to do, what we still need to do, is go for a single-payer Medicare-for-all type program where everybody's in one giant risk pool. Everybody's in, nobody's out.
Dr. Woolhandler, what's the effect of people looking for insurance on these health exchanges when there is only one company? Does that mean the rates, the premiums paid will go sky high? Is that the net effect here?
Well, they won't go necessarily sky high relative to what they've been, which has already been pretty high. They will be higher. There are studies showing that in markets with only one or two insurance companies versus markets with three to five insurance companies, the rates are higher. So, yes, the consumer will be paying a higher rate, but the problem, of course, is the on the Obamacare exchange insurance are very high to begin with. So for someone my age, and I am in my early 60s, if I go to buy a bronze plan, which is the cheapest plan available to me in New York State, if I go to buy a bronze plan, I have to take $5,000 out of my pocket and pay the premium. And then if I get sick, I've got a $5,000 deductible. I need to take another $5,000 out of my pocket, $10,000 total I've paid out of pocket before my insurance pays one penny. So it's an extremely expensive insurance for a middle-income person to be thinking about paying that kind of money for care. So, yes, having a monopoly, as will occur in many counties and states, makes matters worse. It makes the premiums higher. The premiums are quite high, even in areas like New York, where there's not a monopoly at this point.
Dr. Wollhandler, as you pointed out, the United States stands alone in the industrialized world of countries that don't have a universal health care system in place. Therefore, we have one of the most expensive systems with an enormous number of people left out. But as I understand it, the ACA, the Obamacare system in place now, has covered an additional 20 million people, but that leaves 29 or 30 million people still uninsured and many more underinsured, even among that number. What can you tell us about the issue of the United States and its unique situation here? Not such a good situation.
Well, you're absolutely right with those numbers. Less than half of the uninsured have received coverage. So about 20 million have been covered. About 27 million remain uninsured. And to me as a physician, 27 million uninsured people is not acceptable. And furthermore, even if the Obamacare legislation had been rolled out as initially enacted, as 50 states, all 50 states had enacted Medicaid, there still would have been tens of millions of people uninsured. And not just in the short term, over the long term, the Congressional Budget Office is saying 26 million people remain uninsured. So we have not gotten to universal health care, and we're not getting there with the Obamacare legislation, which is why we need to go with Medicare for All. You know, all other developed countries do use some form of national health insurance. Most of them rely on nonprofit national health insurance. They spend 40% less per capita than we do on health care. People in other developed nations like Canada or the Netherlands live 2 to 3 years longer. So where they have these national health programs, you get more care, better health, and you spend less. You know, the United States is really unique among the developed countries in having subsidized private insurance system that is extremely expensive and doesn't cover everyone.
That was Dr. Steffi Wollhandler, co-founder of the group Physicians for a National Health Program and a professor at the City University of New York School of Public Health at Hunter College, where she treats patients in the South Bronx. Learn more about the merits and cost of a single-payer healthcare program by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. With a succession of sometimes shocking smartphone videos revealing widespread police violence targeting people of color across America, and the parallel rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, U.S. corporate media has focused new attention on the issue of America's racial divide in policing and criminal justice. But rarely do journalists or politicians address the critical and related issue of racial wealth inequality. Now a new study has been published, putting into sharp focus the growing divide between the wealth of white, African American, and Latino families, titled The Ever-Growing Gap. Without change, African American and Latino families won't match white wealth for centuries. The report, jointly published by the Corporation for Enterprise Development, or CFED, and the Institute for Policy Studies, examines the growing racial wealth divide for Black and Latino households and the ways that accelerating concentrations of wealth at the top compound and exacerbate this divide. The authors also consider the impact public policy has had in contributing to the racial wealth divide and how new policies can close this gap. Your reporter spoke with one of the study's four authors, Diedrich Asante-Mohammed, director of CFED's Racial Wealth Divide Initiative. Here, Asante Mohammed discusses the major findings of the report and the ways in which wealth disparity along racial lines affect the social fabric of America and its people.
Well, the overall point of the report, and I'll give you the kind of the numbers that everybody used, is just that oftentimes when people think about race and racial inequality, they say, well, look, America's made a lot of progress, and there, you know, is truth that things have changed from 50 or 100 years ago, and that though things might not be moving as fast as people would like, we're on a path toward, getting toward racial equality. And what this report is showing is that as it relates to racial economic inequality, that is not true, that we are on a path to ever-growing racial economic inequality. One of the numbers that is most often cited from the report is that if white wealth were to freeze, not grow at all, it would take over 200 years for African Americans to reach the wealth, the average wealth of white Americans. It would take Latinos over 80 years to reach the wealth of whites. If wealth were frozen today for whites and kept growing at the rate that Black and Latino wealth has been growing for the last 30 years. In 2013, African Americans and Latinos had wealth that was about $500,000 less than white wealth. In 2043, 30 years from 2013, African Americans and Latinos will have about $1 million less in wealth if things continue as they have been for the last 30 years. So we are on a path of great racial economic inequality.
Review for our audience, if you would, the causes of institutional inequality for African Americans and Latinos. That includes a harsh look at mortgage lending policies, government benefits, pay discrimination, and the like.
Well, you know, what many people fail to realize is that the United States as a middle-class economy is not something that has been true since the founding of the country. It's really something that started post-Great Depression with the New Deal and World War II, and that America became a middle-class economy, and it was really white America became a middle-class economy with massive government investments that again, you saw in the New Deal and in programs related to World War II, like the GI Bill, which greatly helped cover the cost of higher education. Connected to the GI Bill, too, is massive home ownership opportunities. And what happened, of course, obviously at that time, you had great legal racial segregation. African Americans weren't able to take advantage of that in the same way Native Americans, a small amount of Latinos in the country, also usually weren't able to take advantage of those opportunities. And so we had a fairly progressive economy where those who were at the bottom were growing at rates equal to, if not sometimes faster than, higher income Americans. But then as after the 60s of the Civil Rights Movement, and African Americans had fought to become, and African Americans and people of color as a whole had fought to become more inclusive of government policies, you saw a lot of these government investments no longer existing or being cut back, and you saw an overall regressive economy. So, there hasn't been an opportunity. America's never invested in a middle-class economy that was inclusive to all, and I think that's one of the main reasons we see the great disparity that still exists today. We also see that for the last 30 years, America has been an economy where the rich get richer and the middle class and lower income are losing ground, and that's been affecting everyone, and that has helped to solidify and strengthen racial economic inequality.
Tell us a bit about the policy prescriptions that your report recommends for reversing the growing inequality and specifically racial inequality across the U.S.
Let me first state that, you know, oftentimes people hear about these problems and they, you know, think, well, you know, we don't have a whole bunch of money to help deal with this issue, so there's really no way that we're going to, you know, have a policy prescription to this. But one thing this report highlights is that America already invests over $600 billion a year in wealth and asset development. And just the problem is they invest at over half a trillion dollars a year in mostly wealthy people. So actually, America's spending over $600 billion a year in concentrating wealth among the richest. If we could take these different types of tax subsidies for home ownership, for even pensions, and make sure that they actually go to much more so low and moderate wealth families, then we have a system where actually investing in, you know, in those that need wealth development and helping to bridge wealth inequality overall, and that would have a very strong impact, particularly in the African-American Latino community. So we need to stop investing in greater inequality and make those investments go to greater equality for all Americans, including African-Americans, Latinos, Native Americans, and Asian-Americans who are low wealth.
That was Diedrich Asante Mohammed, Director of the Corporation for Enterprise Development's Racial Wealth Divide Initiative. Find a link to the Ever-Growing Gap report and related analysis and commentary by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. According to the Red Cross, the flood devastating Louisiana is now the worst natural disaster to strike the United States since Hurricane Sandy in 2012. The flood, triggered by 31 inches of rain that fell in 15 hours, has killed 13 people and damaged an estimated 40,000 homes. An earlier flood that inundated West Virginia after 10 inches of rain fell on June 23rd killed 26 people, damaged more than 1,000 homes, and washed out bridges, further isolating rural communities. In the small town of Clendenin, 20 miles northeast of West Virginia's capital, Charleston, the water in the Elk River rose 33 feet, flooding many homes. 2 months after the storm, many local residents complain about the slow recovery. During the first few weeks after the flood, hundreds of volunteers came to help. But the disaster soon faded from the headlines, and the number of volunteers dwindled. But the need for help continues, even as more widespread flooding in Louisiana has been the focus of news coverage, motivating volunteers to rush there to help. Climate scientists are getting closer to being able to connect certain weather disasters to climate change. The easiest connection to make is with more frequent heat waves. But flooding, measured in rainfall, has also been linked to global warming, as rising air temperatures can hold more moisture. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who visited Clendenin, West Virginia recently, spoke with two local women who helped coordinate their own disaster relief program in their town, connecting volunteers to homeowners or churches in need of help. We first hear from Pamela Rausch, followed by her sister-in-law, Sherry Mullins.
These people here, you know, a lot of them are poor, and they have no way to redo, you know, their homes or get supplies or anything like that. So I thought, well, if we go in and at least send people out to them where they don't have to hire workers, that'd be 100% help to them. So that's what we did. And my daughter-in-law actually started this, but then I went down to pick up my grandbaby one day, and she said, sit down, have a seat. So I did. I sat there and I started taking down names as they come in because she got busy. I started taking down names and sending people out and fell in love with it. I mean, from then on, I wanted to do it every day. I did it from daylight till dark, just sat there, send workers out, tell them where they had to go, what they had to do. And the workers, they were so thrilled, you know, to be able to come in and help people. And they were coming in from California, Washington, Florida, all over the United States, just doing whatever they could do to help out. And I would do the interviews, you know, people coming in, if they wanted to put it on the news or if they wanted to put it on the radio, I would do that, and I would send dispatch workers out. And if we had tractor trailers, we had people from all over the United States bring in all kind of contents.
And Sherry Mullins, how and why did you get involved?
I wasn't affected myself because we live up on a hill. But my daughter, my youngest daughter, she lost everything. She lost her home, her car, and her job because she worked here in Clendenin. And I wanted to help out because people had helped her so much through all this. People were so generous to help her, and I thank God for that. But I wanted to help also. So Pam needed someone to come down there and help out. So I just kind of let everything at home go and went down there and started helping. And it makes you feel good that you're able to help someone in some way. It may be something little that you think you're doing, but people are so appreciative to get something, you know, when they've lost everything. And I'm just glad that I got to help.
Pam was saying she took in the names and found out what needed to be done and where the location was, right? You had all that information. Turned it over to you. So what did you do?
Well, whenever someone came in that needed something, we had everything. We brought all the supplies in. We would sort them out on tables. And we also had volunteers to help do that, too. But when someone came in, we would get them their cleaning supplies, boots, clothes, anything that they needed, and that was my job that I helped do, and I really enjoyed helping.
David told me that that the site, where you guys were working from, was closed down. So when did it close, and why did it close? Were people stopped needing help, or volunteers stopped coming, or both? Because it seems like there's still a lot of work that needs to be done.
In the first probably 3 weeks, we had between 300 to 400 people that come in daily, and we would send them out. But then after 3 weeks, it went down to probably maybe 100 to 150 workers. Then by the fourth week, it cut down to like 50 and 60. And by the fifth week, I was getting like 3 per day. And then it got to where after the sixth week, I might get 1 person a day.
So how would either one of you describe the need? I mean, it seems like there's a lot of need here just from being here a couple hours. What do you think?
I feel like the need is still here, but all of the volunteers are quitting. We are still here. If you drive in Clendenin, you can see that we still need volunteers every day. We need a lot of volunteers. I still got my phone number out there. All they have to do is call me. I've still got the workers that need the work done, and I would be willing to get more and help them. But, you know, I can't do it without the volunteers.
That was Pamela Rausch and Sherry Mullins, who are coordinating flood relief efforts in Clendenin, West Virginia. Learn more about the floods devastating West Virginia and Louisiana by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hale and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Nigel Victor Reese, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.